Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a great three-day weekend and got to enjoy the picture-perfect weather around here. But before we move on, I want to acknowledge out loud that yesterday was Memorial Day. I saw so few references to it in any context this year. My inbox was filled with ads for Memorial Day weekend sales of all kinds and activities of all kinds, same in most of the media, plus a lot of talk about the weather. And that's all fine, but let's also acknowledge that this is supposed to be perhaps our most solemn holiday, honoring the memories of Americans who died in wars. It was established after the Civil War, as some of you know, maybe some of you don't, and was originally called Decoration Day. People were supposed to decorate the graves of the soldiers killed in that war. And Decoration Day would actually be today, the 30th of May. It was only in the 1970s for commerce and for the pleasure of a three-day weekend that it was moved to the last Monday in May, regardless of the date, right? Veterans Day, remember the difference, celebrates the veterans still alive. Memorial Day is for those who served and died. Big distinction that people sometimes forget. And unfortunately, we have had plenty of war dead to honor over time. According to the data website Statista, these numbers are mind-blowing if you don't know them. Our deadliest war was the Civil War, in which about 620,000 people died between the two sides. Then you have World War II, 405,000 people. World War I, 116,000 people. The Vietnam War, 58,000-plus Americans. Some of you know every name is engraved on the Vietnam Memorial Wall in D.C., a site worth visiting if you're in the nation's capital. And by the way, not to forget, Vietnam estimates 2 million of its citizens were killed in that war. Around 7,000 Americans have died in the global war on terror, as they called it. 7,000 small by historical standards, some of those other numbers that I just gave you, but it's still 7,000 Americans dead in wars that were questionable at best from September 11, 2001 to the present. So that's Afghanistan and Iraq combined, plus a small number elsewhere in what they call the war on terror. And the Washington Post had an article yesterday with a count of 16 American military veterans who have now been killed in the war in Ukraine. Those were not U.S. military deaths, technically. The Post says those have been private citizens who previously served in this country's military and then who chose to volunteer over in Ukraine to help defend against the Russian invasion. It tells the story, for example, of 45-year-old ex-Green Beret, Paul Mamer of Boise, Idaho, who had been working as an English teacher in Spain and was quoted by his family recently saying his moral compass drove him to enlist with the Ukrainian war effort. There's now a video of a Russian paramilitary leader holding up Mamer's driver's license and Veterans Affairs card and taunting the United States, according to that Washington Post article. So for Paul Mamer and more than a million other Americans over the centuries, as well as the war dead in the countries we fought, though some people won't like me saying that, we acknowledge Memorial Day, Decoration Day, on this day, May 30th, when it originally was. May you all rest in peace. And let's try not to have any more wars if we can avoid it, eh? An article on Slate reminds us that some U.S. military officers are predicting we will be at war with China in the next few years. But it cites as good news this statement by President Biden last week at the G7 summit in Japan about the increasing belligerence on both sides, maybe getting ready to tone down.
We should have an open hotline. At the Bali conference, that's what the President Xi and I agreed we were going to do and meet on. And then this silly balloon that was carrying two freight cars worth of spying equipment was flying over the United States, and it got shot down, and everything changed in terms of talking to one another. I think you're going to see that begin to thaw very shortly.
I think you're going to begin to see that, or I'm going to, I think you're going to see that begin to thaw very shortly, said President Joe Biden. Republicans, of course, running for president seem to be falling all over themselves, trying to be tougher than the next person on China. Ron DeSantis, did you hear this? Even signed a bill this month, with all the other things Ron DeSantis did, this barely made national news, prohibiting citizens of China from buying land in parts of Florida. His press release on the signing says Governor Ron DeSantis cracks down on communist China. So with all that as backdrop, with us now is the writer of the Slate article on Biden and China, Fred Kaplan, who covers military affairs for Slate in his column called War Stories. He is also the author of books, including his latest, The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Fred, always good to have you. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
For you as a military affairs writer, any thoughts first on Memorial Day as we acknowledge it or barely acknowledge it in the United States, or the American veterans volunteering in Ukraine?
Well, it is true. I mean, you said that you saw very little note of it. This is only, the second year when we've had nobody dying in a major war abroad? It is interesting. There is something like, the estimates I've read, something like 4,000 Americans having fought in Ukraine. I don't think all at the same time, but over a period of the last year or so. Most of them, as that Post story recounted, veterans who either feel empty or feel that this is a war that they need to go fight for, something with principles that seem a bit clearer than some of the wars that the U.S. government has been involved in recent years. By comparison, I mean the Spanish Civil War, where, remember, there was something called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which was a lot of Democratic and leftist people in the United States went over to help fight against Franco. From all kinds of countries, 32,000 people went over to fight, and about 5,000 died.
Wow.
So this is what's going on in Ukraine isn't anything remotely like that. But it is a war that I think, unless something quite drastic happens politically, is going to go on for quite a while.
And we'll get back to talking about Ukraine a little later in the segment. But the clip we played of President Biden is what you cite at the beginning of your article on avoiding war with China. But you also cite those military officers who predict we will be at war with China, including one who predicted as early as this year. So can we start there? And you'll tell us who's predicting war with China and why?
Well, it was in March of 2021 that Admiral Philip Davidson, who was the outgoing commander of U.S. military forces in Pacific, said in a hearing that he thought we would be at war with China in the next 6 years. He said that without having his testimony approved by any superior, which was very unusual. It also was something that was disputed explicitly by the Defense Department's own report about Chinese military power, which doesn't make any prediction like this at all. There have been statements that Chairman Xi and other Chinese officials have talked about by the end of this decade having attained a certain level of a professional army. But nothing even remotely hinting at being able or even willing to go to war for Taiwan or any other goal that it has in mind. What's going on politically, it's very interesting. We might remember earlier this month, Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor and his Chinese counterpart, met in Vienna and held 10 hours of talks, which is just extraordinary. And according to the readouts from both sides, talking about the most fundamental issues dividing the U.S. and China now. At the end of it, the White House released a statement calling the talks candid, substantive, and constructive. China called them candid, in-depth, substantive, and constructive.
Same language, basically.
Basically, and these things mean something. It might sound kind of empty and bland to us, but those adjectives mean something. They mean that things were discussed and it was actually positive and creating the basis for further constructive dialogue. So, and then put Biden's remark on that. And then, you know, the thing about the balloon, right before the balloon happened, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, was going to go over to Beijing and talk with Xi himself. The first time that a Secretary of State had done so for 6 years, presumably to lay out some areas where there might be some re-engagement. The balloon made that impossible. And the question is just whether and when things can get back in track. I assume it's going to be at the meeting in Bali later this year. And it's the kind of thing that really has to be done by Biden and Xi directly. And unless there's some other crazy incident between now and then, I think both sides have a real incentive for this to happen.
And we'll talk about the Ukraine war relationship to this. China kind of caught in the middle in a certain respect. But you wrote that good news article last week. Then just yesterday, I saw the reports of China turning down an invitation for the two countries' top defense officials to meet. Did you see that or know what that's about?
Yeah. Well, this is the second time this has happened. There have generally been, you know, routine military-to-military relations. We have them with Russia, even on certain things, with China, with all kinds of countries. And there are regular meetings, and twice in a row now China has said, no, we don't want to do this. Now, this is the Chinese military force. It's not necessarily Xi. They may be waiting for cues to be read from the political level. I don't know. These things are quite cryptic and, from an outsider's point of view, impenetrable. It is disturbing. It does show that, you know, maybe they're telling Biden, hey, don't get too far ahead on your skis. We still have a lot of things to work out. You know, there are very good reasons why you want to have generals and generals talking with each other. I mean, even the U.S. and Russia, which has almost no relations now, there are what are called deconfliction talks or deconfliction notifications, say in Syria, where both sides have military forces. Each notifies the other when certain things are going to happen, so that, you know, you don't ram an airplane into another guy's airplane. It's just natural, self-interested kinds of things. And it's that sort of thing that is not going on with the U.S. and China now. And, that creates a dangerous situation for regardless of what political signals might be intended.
So listeners, our phones are open on this Decoration Day, this day after Memorial Day. We're going to invite you for one thing, and screeners, get ready, to decorate the airwaves with any way you want to honor anyone in your life who was killed in a war. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I mentioned some of the top wars for U.S. deaths at the top of the segment. Some others I didn't mention, the Korean War, right? We still have veterans from the Korean War alive today. 36,000 plus Americans died in the Korean War. There's a memorial wall for that in D.C. as well as the Vietnam Memorial War. 25,000 Americans, according to that chart on Statista. 25,000 Americans died in the Revolutionary War that founded the independence of this country. And there are others at that, the War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, and others. So a lot of war dead in U.S. history to honor on Memorial Day. If you want to honor anyone in your life who was killed in Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, Korea, any one you knew personally, feel free. Or anything you want to say or ask about war or peace with China or the war in Ukraine, which we'll also talk about in more detail. There were attacks in both Kyiv and Moscow over the weekend. Or anything else related, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can also text to that number, 212-433-WNYC, for Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate. Fred, our non-troop support for Ukraine is controversial enough. What's the U.S. commitment to defending Taiwan if China were to invade? Does it include troops, which we're not sending to Ukraine?
No, it does not. Although we have this thing that we call strategic ambiguity with Taiwan, and it's very bizarre. And for anybody not deeply immersed in the arcana of international relations, it sounds almost absurd. We do not recognize Taiwan as an independent nation. However, we do send them billions of dollars worth of weapons, and we do have a treaty if they are attacked, that we will help them defend themselves. Now, Biden has poured even further confusion on this by saying three times in answer to a question, he's been asked on three separate occasions, will we defend Taiwan if they are attacked? And he has said yes.
Yeah.
And as one columnist, I forget who, wrote that, one time is a mistake, three times is policy. Does it mean we will actually, take part in the war? That's not part of the commitment. But it's a very unusual thing, the Chinese call it, one nation, two systems. It's hard to say what would happen if China actually did attack Taiwan. But U.S., some aspect of the United States would be involved, whether troops would be sent. Nobody is saying, and it's deliberate that we don't say.
Alan in Dobbs Ferry wants to remember somebody. Alan, you're on WNYC on this day after Memorial Day. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Brian. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we got you.
Great. So I wanted to mention my uncle, Herbert Hom. He was the first American-born member of his family, and he was killed in combat in Korea. And, the way that I remember him each year is in Dobbs Ferry, New York. We have a really nice, small Memorial Day event, and the veterans come out and other people come out, and it's very solemn. And so that's the way it should be done. But yesterday, a 30-year veteran of the Marines was the Grand Marshal of the parade in Dobbs Ferry, and he politicized the event and talked about things that I don't think should be talked about on Memorial Day. I think we've got enough of a problem with polarization in this country that Memorial Day is something that should bring us together, that should not drive us apart.
In which direction did that person politicize the event?
Well, it was sort of multiple things. I mean, one of the things he raised was voter ID laws.
Wow.
He brought up, it was nuts. At one point, he was talking about, the United States not being a racist nation, and Martin Luther King never said that blacks and whites should be equal. He just said they should be like brothers and sisters.
Wow.
He brought up the Second Amendment. Yeah, it was painful not to heckle, but it would have been disrespectful, I think, to heckle. At one point, he was heckled. It's just such, I don't know, the word that comes to mind is sacrilegious, even though, of course, that's not the right word.
Yeah, civic, something like that. Sac civic, maybe we just coined a word. Alan, I'm curious if the Dobbs Ferry event was a parade or just a gathering.
Right, so each year it's just a gathering, and it's a rather small gathering. This year, it was the beginning of the parade. So there was a huge crowd because the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and various people are there with their kids. And so we had a big crowd because it was, in essence, the staging ground before we, you know, started the parade.
Interesting. Al, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. Disturbing as that is about what the Grand Marshal of the parade said, according to that caller, in Dobbs Ferry yesterday. And Fred, yeah, there are Memorial Day parades. I guess we tend to have big Memorial Day sales. Big Memorial Day sale. I got how many emails in my inbox? Big Memorial Day sales and small Memorial Day parades.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about this. You know, especially since the draft ended, such a small percentage of Americans serve in the military, and not that much bigger a percentage even know people who did. I was thinking, and you know, this is very strange, but I think I knew maybe one person who died in the Vietnam War. I know more reporters who died in Iraq and Afghanistan than I know American soldiers who did.
It's so, you know, class-based.
There's something fundamentally, flawed, and I'm not saying we need to bring back the draft or anything like that. But this is a terribly skewed society for when it comes to honoring or even having any relationship with the people who make, you know, what is called the ultimate sacrifice.
And it's class-based to some degree. The former New York Congressman Charles Rangel, in just relatively recent years, used to call for reinstituting the draft because he saw it as an economic draft, the way things stand now, which disproportionately draws in people of color who find that the best way to make a living or get a college education paid for.
And, you know, it's worth noting that now where there's so little unemployment, the military is having a hard time recruiting the number of people that they need to fill all the billets.
We had a recruiter on the show recently who was lamenting that. In addition to, interestingly, they brought up too many Americans unfit to serve, literally, physically unfit to serve. Yeah. They can't pass the physical fitness test. And then it's also politically polarizing. Like the caller from Dobbs Ferry was talking about the, you know, relatively far right, I guess, Grand Marshal of the local event there. And the military tends to be a bastion for more conservative Americans. Do you think that's right?
There is a lot of survey data which indicates that that's true, yes.
Rachel in Stamford wants to remember somebody. Rachel, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you for talking about this. I just wanted to bring into the conversation the number of service members that have died by suicide. My best friend about 6 years ago died by suicide. His name was Isaiah Coker, and then two soldiers from my own unit died by suicide, Sergeant Jonathan Burbank and Specialist Wayne Hill. And I think I remember seeing a artist had made a memorial in which it showed that so many more service members died by suicide than actually in combat in Iraq. So I just wanted to bring that into the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you did. And I'll note that that's such a prevalent item on people's minds, Fred, that three of our 10 lines are people calling with stories like the one that Rachel just told of veterans who committed suicide after coming home as opposed to dying in the war per se. I don't know if they get listed on any of the memorials or as war dead. I guess not really.
I don't think so.
Not officially. No. But obviously something worth talking about. And as we have more explicitly on Veterans Day, different than Memorial Day, a big issue on, you know, and one of the many reasons to avoid war. Right, Fred?
Yeah. Also, it's another sign of what we were talking about a few minutes ago, the neglect. You know, I think we prefer to put this out of our minds, out of sight, out of mind. It's kind of amazing if you think of all the other countries in the world. We don't really have to think about this as something that affects our own lives personally, you know, day to day living, and really almost never have, which again makes this neglect easy to get away with.
Another reason that Rangel used to argue for reinstituting the draft was if the sons and daughters of Congress members, House members and U.S. senators had to serve, our political leaders would be more reluctant to beat the war drums. And to that point, how do you see the bipartisan rhetorical toughness on China right now? And listeners, if you're just joining us, Fred Kaplan from Slate is with us. His latest article is on, or one of his latest articles is on prospects for the U.S. and China avoiding war with each other. All this rhetorical toughness on China, including DeSantis signing that bill this month prohibiting land purchases by Chinese citizens in parts of Florida.
Was that by Chinese American citizens?
I think it's by citizens of China.
Oh, okay. I find it very disturbing. I mean, you know, the House this year created a special committee to look into things about China, which, you know, on the face of it is not a bad idea. But it's like the only thing on Capitol Hill that has this air of bipartisanship now, because everybody on the committee is just beating up on China and raising the alarm about a war with China and about how, you know, dreadfully threatening China is. And, I've talked with the people who actually look at this thing closely. Well, look, China, we have a lot of differences with China. I don't mean to paper over any of them, and we shouldn't. And China is doing a lot of things that are quite disturbing that also should not be papered over. But look, they neither have the desire nor by any means the capability of going to war in the next few years. You know, the Pentagon every year puts out a report, it's congressionally mandated, on Chinese military capabilities. And each of the last 2 years, there are several passages showing why they just are not in any position to, for example, invade Taiwan anytime soon. One of the things they talk about is that even in the Chinese military press, they talk about the five incapables, five things that the Chinese military right now is incapable of doing. For example, commanders, they cannot judge situations, deploy forces, understand the intentions of higher authorities, make operational decisions in combat, or manage unexpected developments. These are things that their own commanders acknowledge that they are unable to do. There's this fallacy. I had an old professor who talked about the fallacy of small-scale maps. You know, you look at a map of the world, and there's enormous China, and there's this little dot of Taiwan. And so you think, oh, my God, China could overwhelm Taiwan in a second. Well, you know, there aren't any really convenient landing spots in the coastlines of Taiwan. There are 20 million people there, including a capital with 2.5 million. The Chinese military has about 3 amphibious landing crafts. Another thing to think about, the last war that China fought was in 1979. It was a month-long border skirmish with Vietnam. It was a few thousand people died, and China did not win. And so maybe there are like 2 ancient Chinese officers who have ever fought, who have ever fired a gun with the intention of killing anybody. Now, Taiwan hasn't had any military experience either, but they're being trained and armed by people who have. So, I mean, there's this blithe way that we talk about an invasion of Taiwan or Chinese military experience, because they have so many people and it's so big, it doesn't mean that they can go to war in a second. It's a lot harder than the very flimsy looks at things might suggest.
And once upon a time, people thought superpower Russia would overtake Afghanistan.
Oh my God. Not just once upon a time.
And superpower United States would overtake Afghanistan easily. But Ron DeSantis won't let Chinese citizens buy land in parts of China. And, you know, if you're a Chinese trans person, you're not even allowed to visit Florida. Oh, no, I'm kidding. I'm getting my DeSantis campaign points mixed up. We'll continue in a minute with Fred Kaplan, Slate's military affairs columnist, on this day after Memorial Day, on Biden and China and the Republican presidential hopefuls, on the likelihood or not of a U.S.-China war. And we'll turn the page some and talk about the state of the war in Ukraine as well. We could be at both a military and political turning point on that right now. And Fred wrote about, and I see one of our callers wants to ask about, a certain relevant birthday that's in the news. Stay tuned and find out whose as we continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Fred Kaplan, Slate's military affairs columnist, on this day after Memorial Day, on the likelihood or not of war with China in the relatively near future. We're going to get into Ukraine. We're going to cite that birthday that some of you know who it is and some of you may not. But Dan in Fairfield has an interesting question about a prospective U.S.-China war. Dan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, good morning. As a longtime listener, thank you for all of your show and everything you provide for us listening. My question is that if there is a conflict between China and the United States, whereabouts do you think that conflict is going to be held?
Interesting question. Fred, does that come to the shores of the United States?
Oh, no. I mean, one thing that the Pentagon's intelligence report said is that the China's ability to project power anywhere beyond Taiwan, really, is, quote, in its infancy. I wouldn't worry. I mean, look, they do have ICBMs. I mean, if they just wanted to lob off a few ICBMs, that would hit the United States, and then we would clobber them in retaliation. I don't see that happening. No, it's likely to be over something that gets out of hand in Taiwan, maybe in the South China Sea. They have in recent years created these artificial islands out in the South China Sea and then turned them into military bases and declared that this is now Chinese territory, even though, according to everybody else in the world, it's part of international waters. So one could imagine an escalating tense situation, there being some blows at sea over the contesting the right of a ship to pass by, or maybe they're forming a blockade around Taiwan, which would be a lot easier than invading Taiwan, we send some carriers in and we cross something that they say is their territory, and they fire a swarm of anti-ship missiles, that kind of thing. It would be step by step by step a war escalating beyond what either side had intentionally desired or expected, and then careening out of control. I think that's how it would happen if it happens.
Listener texts, DeSantis is barring people from China from buying land in Florida, but Russians have been and are buying up land there. So interesting commentary by that listener writing us a text on, I guess, how the Republicans view China versus how they view Russia as, in some respects, a potential ally. Saul in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hi, Saul.
Yes, good morning, Brian, and good morning, Mr. Kaplan. Given the focus of this conversation on individuals that come to mind on Memorial Day, as well as the China topic, I'd like to ask Mr. Kaplan about Dr. Kissinger, who has been celebrating his 100th birthday, I think, on May 27th, and is being both lauded and vilified all over the news at the moment. He certainly comes to mind with respect to all the tragic losses during many wars in the United States, from Vietnam to the military situation in Chile to Cambodia to many other places. And with respect to China, he's always been a proponent of engagement with China, but sometimes, at least some critics believe, to the detriment of the United States. I read, Mr. Kaplan, I don't know if you did, a recent book called America's Second, How America's Elites Are Making China Stronger, arguing that particularly people engaged in commercial interaction with China over the last 30, 40 years, prominent people, have actually contributed to the type of strength and confrontation we now believe we may have with China. A big chunk of that book is devoted to Henry Kissinger. So I'd like to ask Mr. Kaplan for his assessment how we should think about Dr. Kissinger in the conversation we're having this morning.
So thank you for that. And I will note for our audience that Fred did write an article on Slate on the 100th birthday of Henry Kissinger. So, Fred, where do you want to take it?
Yeah, well, I'm mainly on the side of Team Vilify, I guess. Mm. I mean, Kissinger is to be commended for a few things. You know, the détente with the Soviet Union, the opening of China, the shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East. But even those things didn't have much long-term effect. I mean, Jimmy Carter's negotiated peace between Israel and Egypt has endured all this time. Kissinger's peace with Syria and Israel has not. His opening to China was primarily as a part of a triangulation to beat back the Soviet Union and try to coerce them out of supporting Vietnam. Neither of those things worked. But more than that, I mean, Kissinger has been involved in some of the most disreputable and really reprehensible aspects of U.S. foreign policy in the last half century. I mean, secret bombings of Cambodia, Vietnam. I mean, that was in conjunction with Nixon. He was pushing Nixon on. But for example, Chile, where Salvador Allende, a socialist, was elected president in a democratic election. Nixon was about to receive a briefing from State Department officials calling for him to make a kind of a modus, reach some kind of modus vivendi with Allende. Kissinger got, who was national security advisor, got the briefing postponed and convinced Nixon that he had to crush Allende. He had to make the economy scream. And so Kissinger was the head of a committee, which was mainly peopled by CIA agents, to wreck the Chilean economy, to pay off truck drivers to go on strike, to help support the military. The economy was reeling as a result of this, and Allende was overthrown. General Pinochet came in power and started a campaign of brutal repression and torture of his critics. They assassinated a prominent exile critic, Orlando Letelier, with a car bombing in the streets of Washington, D.C., which also killed a young American colleague of his. No protests of this by the United States or by Kissinger. In fact, later declassified documents showed Kissinger encouraging Pinochet to, you know, do what you have to do and do it as quickly as possible. Mm. He did the same thing with the coup plotters in Argentina. Yes, we understand that you have a civil war going on. Do what you need to do. Encouraging Suharto's, the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, East Pakistan's invasion. Just, I mean, all over the map, just some of the most brutal events of late 20th century Henry Kissinger supported and got the United States to encourage. And, you know, Kissinger is known to be a realpolitik, you know, realism in international affairs. Now, don't clutter your policy, which should be based just on foreign policy interests, with notions of morality and that sort of thing. Well, I mean, he wrecked realpolitik, too, because as a result of American alignment with some of the most dreadful things on the planet, he actually harmed American national security interests. He gave America a black eye in the world. He made us look bad. He made us look immoral. And even, you know, the most profound practitioners and theoreticians of realpolitik, people like George Kennan, there was always a moral undercurrent to their realism. They always recognized that what really had to sell to the world was the image of what the United States is, that would have the biggest impact. And Kissinger, I think, did as much as any one person in the United States to wreck that whole notion of that dimension of international realism.
So mostly on Team Vilify on the occasion of Henry Kissinger's 100th birthday. Fred Kaplan, the military affairs columnist for Slate. Ukraine is going to wind up getting short shrift in this conversation, but you did also write an article this month, talk about back in the old days, as you were just doing, the using China as a way of triangulating. President Xi of China called Zelensky, and you wrote an article about that. So how do you see China's role in that war, if any, and how China's role relates to the U.S. and Russia? Who's triangulating who?
Yeah. Well, I think China could have a productive effect on this, but not the way they're doing it. I mean, Xi is kind of in a bind. Xi signed this no-limits partnership with Putin about a month before Putin invaded Ukraine. It is believed that Xi really didn't know that that was going to happen. Then he got stuck with a guy. He hasn't provided any military assistance to Russia, though he's providing a lot of economic aid. He's keeping their economy afloat. He offered a peace plan to Ukraine, which really was kind of a non-starter, but Zelensky was interested enough in it to at least want to have a conversation. It looks like all the Xi is really trying to do is to split Europe apart from the United States, which, by the way, is one of his main long-term strategic foreign policy interests. But the Europeans aren't biting. They're very much in favor of continuing to support Ukraine. They see behind what's behind Xi's rather shallow peace offering. But, you know, I do think it's true. If Xi really wanted to have a peace in Ukraine and put the pressure on Russia and attached continued economic aid to their withdrawal, he could have an effect. But, you know, he has two conflicting goals on Ukraine. One, he wants to keep the United States preoccupied in Europe so they can't put more military forces in the Pacific. He wants to split Europe from the United States for the same reason, to weaken the United States. But he wants to build up his alliance with Russia to that end. But if Russia is just going to be a burden, if Russia is just going to be a drain, and if an alliance with Russia is going to make him, make China, make Xi less appealing to the Europeans that he wants to be closer with, then it becomes counterproductive. So he has some rather strategic decisions to make in the coming months.
And I know we've gone very long in this segment, and apologies to our next guest who's standing by, but I want to extend for one more phone call so that we can end with another listener paying tribute to another loved one lost in war on this day after Memorial Day, this Decoration Day, as it used to be called, May 30th, 2023. And it's going to be Susan in Oakland, California. Susan, you're on WNYC. Hi there. We have a minute for you.
Hi. Okay. I will talk quickly because this is a firsthand memory. I was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island in 1940. I was living in a home owned by my grandfather for housing for his sons. We lived, my father, who was not in the war, I was five, my brother was four. Upstairs lived my uncle Arnold Gavitt's family, and they were a wife and a three-year-old and a one-year-old. And this was May 1945. All this whole story has been verified before she died by my Aunt Dot. I remember the last memory I have of my Uncle Arnold was he came home. He had on his khaki uniform, and he got down on the floor, and we played horsey. And there were three of us on his back. The little one was too little. Months later, May 1945, he was killed in Okinawa. And one army officer came to the door and told my aunt he was dead. That was it, and went away. And I just wanted to pay tribute to my Uncle Arnold Gavitt and his brother Harold, who did come home. So there were three boys in that family. Two were serving.
Susan,
every year somebody puts a flag on his grave. We think it's the Disabled Veterans Organization.
Susan, thank you very much. Yeah, there are organizations that do that on Decoration Day.
That would have been one of the last casualties, too.
Yeah, in May of 1945 in Okinawa. Wow, a listener who remembers somebody who died at the end of World War II. Fred, do they do that anymore? I've seen it in movies and on TV shows where somebody comes in person representing the Pentagon.
Yes, they do.
If you lose a loved one, they do. Yeah. Fred Kaplan writes the War Stories column for Slate. His latest two articles are on the prospects for war or not with China and on Henry Kissinger's 100th birthday. Fred, thank you so much.
Sure, anytime.